From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Hello, I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
And Happy New Year, Joel.
And to you also, Steve.
We have a topic that's appropriate for the wintertime, and that is keeping cool.
Oh, yeah, that's
keeping
good.
Cool.
And I think about that every day.
you look at the manuals that come with transceivers and amplifiers and even some power supplies, and they always caution, which, of course, most people don't read, that you need to have space around the unit for air to circulate and all that. I mean, Joel, from a professional standpoint, what is the importance of keeping cool?
Well, it's very important. It is one of the primary causes of equipment failure. And what happens is a number of things. Some of it's fairly subtle. By the way, we'll talk about the fact that there are really two distinct temperature ranges to talk about. But one of the limiting factors is that when equipment is operating, the current running through the parts results in dissipation of heat. And you can kind of look at it in a gross sense. The power dissipated is the total power put into the equipment less the power that comes out in some way. So if you have a 100-watt transmitter that puts out 100 watts, but it requires 200 watts of DC on the input, 50% of the power that comes out of the power supply is turning into heat.
Wow.
Those are the only two choices. I'm just making that up. That's,
sure.
That's fairly low efficiency. But nonetheless, that heat has to be able to escape, or the components in the transmitter get hotter and hotter and hotter. And what happens is each component has its own temperature rating. And if the temperature is exceeded, first thing that happens is the values can change. Resistors get higher typically in value, and some capacitors do as well. Sometimes the performance characteristics of solid-state devices will change with temperature. Used to be in the early days of solid state, it was a classic runaway problem where the more current that went through a transistor, the hotter it got, and the hotter it got, the more current it would let through. And what would happen would be the transistor would be said to run away. It would just kind of all of a sudden draw as much current as you could possibly provide and eventually turn into smoke and molten stuff.
I'm laughing because I've had that happen to me.
Yes.
It's spectacular when it does. Yes.
So it's a kind of a positive feedback loop. I think most silicon transistors don't have that problem in the same way, and circuits can be designed in such a way that they self-regulate that, so you can have bias arrangements that additional current causes additional bias, which causes additional or reduction in the current, so it doesn't have to be that way. But that's a classic kind of temperature problem. And of course, what happens also is temperature causes changes in sizes of things. Things get bigger when they're hot, so you can have the condition where contacts that are close together can actually run into each other if they get too hot. Now, if you have a transceiver and you do not have enough ventilation around it, the power just continues to build up. It just, the heat in the components continues to rise until something fails. And that's the issue. So you need to have enough cooling air going through the equipment or around the equipment to avoid that problem. And of course, the hotter it is outside, the harder it is for that to happen. So there's also an ambient temperature requirement that says do not operate this equipment above a certain temperature.
Now, that's a very good point. I hadn't thought of that. In other words, if you're operating, let's say it's a de-expedition on a tropical island and it's 100 degrees outside, that could be an issue, correct?
Yes, the equipment will get hotter faster and will be harder to cool and will probably require additional space or cooling fans to move enough air to keep the equipment cool. I said there were two kinds of temperature requirements. One is when it's actually operating, which is what we've been talking about. But there's another one that is quite important, and that is storage requirements. Just like a chocolate bar has a certain storage requirement. I mean, it doesn't go bad exactly, but you probably don't want to look at it again after you've had it in too hot a place for too long. And so components can actually be destroyed by heat even when they're not operating. If you picture a wax paper capacitor, you know, the wax all melts, it's not going to work very well anymore. I don't think anybody uses wax paper capacitors anymore, but There are quite a few around, and it's just what I thought of that moment, but it's something to think about. And there's kind of an in-between case where people say, oh, well, I have a storage requirement. It's going to be hot today, but I'm not going to operate the rig. I'll just keep it turned off, and that will put me into the storage mode. Well, that's not quite true. A lot of people aren't aware of the fact that in most or many kinds of equipment, particularly transmitters that have high current stages at the output stages, for example, the on-off switch does not typically remove the power from the final transistors.
That's true, especially in modern rigs.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely, because the final stages might draw a peak current of 25 amps. That requires a pretty hefty switch. So the designers instead use a small switch. They switch the low-level stages under the thinking that, well, if I don't drive any excitation into the final amplifier, it won't have any current. Well, that's true if everything's working the way it's supposed to, but if you have a very hot environment and you have full power applied to the collectors of the output transistors, something in that circuit could fail that causes the output transistors to draw current, and strange things could happen. We had a classic case of this in our town. A person had a VHF transmitter on his boat, had it turned off. The boat was buttoned up in the summer, as they often are for the week in between the weekends, and it gets as hot as an oven in the cabin of a sailboat or any kind of boat that's buttoned up. I know that from long experience of opening up boats and going into them, that it's quite warm in there for a while. Apparently this was wired right to the battery, is a nice way to run a transceiver, except that the full 13.8 volts was available to the radio. Something failed, and the final amplifier stages started oscillating with nobody aboard, and nobody knew, except that it happened to be oscillating on the input frequency of our local repeater. And it took quite a bit of detective work for the folks to define that problem and get the radio depowered and shut down. So the storage does not just mean turned off. Storage means power completely removed from the equipment. So that's an important distinction to keep in mind.
Can this be an issue for hams that have mobile, say, 2-meter, 70-centimeter transceivers in their cars?
Absolutely. If it's wired right to the battery, which is often recommended, if your car gets hot in the summer when it's sitting in the parking lot,
yes,
you could have this problem very easily. So it's good to think about, and maybe instead of opening up the hood and taking the battery, disconnecting it from the battery, you might be able to remove a fuse or something, and that's a safe way to do it. Much better to do that than to find it melted when you get in the car later, or worse yet, your whole car burned down.
Let's take a break and listen to DX Engineering.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
Remember your first contact? The excitement of that first CQ? The exhilaration of making your first QSO? At DX Engineering, we know that feeling too. That's why we've committed to making your on-air experience the very best it can be. DX Engineering ships quickly, which means less station downtime. And we have free shipping for almost any order over $99. We've recently expanded our inventory, so you don't have to wait for the gear you need. DX Engineering has introduced all new radio products and revived legendary brands, all with the goal of helping you enjoy amateur radio. Most importantly, the DX Engineering team is here to help you. You've got a team of highly experienced hams ready to work out technical issues, answer questions, and help you optimize your station performance. That excitement you felt from the first contact, it can happen again and again with help from DX Engineering. DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back, Joel. We've been talking about heat and cold and all that,
right.
But what about fans? And heat sinks, too, for that matter.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's all part of the process of getting heat away from the equipment itself. The fan just moves more air past the equipment or through the sensitive areas of the equipment than would happen via thermal conduction or convection that occurs because the items get hot and the heat tends to rise and so forth. Heat sinks, if they're oriented properly and have air around them, will allow more surface area to transfer heat from the equipment into the environment. And that's all to the plus.
Well, I know my power supply for my HF transceiver does not have a fan, has a sizable heat sink on it. And I have to admit, I keep the power supply in a bookshelf. It doesn't have the best air circulation. So far, I haven't had a disaster with it. I keep it on all the time. But I'm assuming it would function better in terms of heat dissipation if I had better circulation.
Well, maybe. I mean, you only need so much. And I guess the real test is after you've been operating it for a while, put your fingers on the heat sink and see if it's gotten very hot. You know, it should. It should be a little warm. That's the way it works. But if it gets excessively hot and it keeps getting hotter, it may indicate you have a problem. I mean, that's what we're really talking about is buildup of heat. I was going to go back to that earlier question about having stuff in your car. It occurs to me that one way to find out how hot your car is getting is to take a potato or something similar and put it near where your radio is or your power supply is or the power amplifier is and have it sit there through a 8-hour period or whatever your car is parked for during the day, and very quickly take it out and stick a meat thermometer in it and see what the temperature reads. And that should give you a good idea of what your equipment is experiencing. And you can compare that with both the operating and the storage ratings of the equipment. Mm-hmm. And that way you have some measure of knowing what's going on. And if you can be higher tech than that, if you have one of the modern volt-ohm milliamers that has a temperature probe,
yes,
they can give you real-time, quick reading of the temperature.
Now, what about fans, Joel? I know a number of hams complain that, for example, the fan in their transceiver is running too loud and so on and so forth. Some fans have different levels of RPMs that they'll choose depending on the heat and so on. Obviously, I would think you wouldn't want to have your fan run slower than it ought to.
That's true.
Safe to say.
And you know, engineers tend to be safe, so they tend to run things faster than they might absolutely need to for the cooling requirements, because they don't know, of course, what temperature the environment is that you're going to put this in. So if you have to have it so it'll work in Borneo or something, maybe in your air-conditioned shack, it doesn't need to run so fast. I've actually modified equipment to run slower with temperature. There was a circuit in a Hinson Kink in QST that allowed a series resistor to put the line to the DC-operated fan, and then if the temperature got too hot, it resulted in a short across the resistor so the fan could go faster. And that's quite effective, and that's essentially what is built into some equipment. And frankly, I suffered with loud power supply fans for a long time and had to keep the power supplies far from the station so I could operate the radio. And of course, then the cables are longer and the voltage drop is higher and all kinds of – so you have all kinds of issues to deal with. I finally went with a linear power supply that has no fan, stays on all the time just like yours. It's way overrated for what I'm using it for most of the time, and it just sits there as if it were not doing anything. I have to remember if I'm going away for a month to turn it off, but
yes,
otherwise it avoids that problem. So, you know, it's a trade-off. I guess anybody that's designing equipment could design it so it didn't need a fan, but it would probably need to be bigger and heavier to allow more heat dissipation or have a different kinds of components that don't generate as much heat, if you can imagine those. But somebody once told me as an undergraduate that the definition of an engineer is somebody who can do for a dollar what any idiot could do for five. So the idea is to design something that is optimum. You want to make it small, compact, and efficient and inexpensive. And they try to do all those things. Sometimes you end up needing a fan.
Exactly. In fact, I have seen guys who have linear amplifiers. I'm talking in this case like 1.5 kW linears. And in the wintertime, they take the heat coming off the linear amplifier and will actually put it into ducting with a fan and use it to heat the room in which they're in.
In the summertime, you could heat bricks outside and then bring them inside when it becomes wintertime. But you know, you have to have something that works all year long is, I guess, my point.
So the point is to keep cool,
yes,
to keep reasonably cool.
Yes.
If you want your equipment to perform well and to last a long time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Performing well is a key. You know, the ratings people have for equipment should mean that the equipment will operate to specifications. Oftentimes, specifications are sort of minimal standards for what equipment needs to do. And if you have equipment that you're pushing right up to the limit and it's operating just at specifications, the distortion may be higher than you're used to. It may put out more harmonics than you're used to, but it may still be within spec, but it's not as good as it could be. So keep that in mind. You'd never want to push right up against the specifications, temperature or otherwise.
Yes, true. Well, do you have a moment for a question?
Sure.
Well, all right, Joel, we have a very long question. I think this must hold the record for the longest question I've ever seen on the Doctor Is In podcast.
Oh,
but we're going to do it justice. Okay. Ken, KK6ZHK, is asking Joel if you can help him with what appears to be an RFI issue. When keying up on CW and raising the power to over 300 watts, he says, my transceiver disrupts the USB driver for my computer keyboard such that I can no longer type and I have to reboot the computer. Thinking myself clever, I swapped out the wired keyboard for a wireless keyboard only to discover that a different USB driver was disabled. In this instance, the USB driver was the connection between my rig and the computer. In that case, it unfortunately kills my connection to my rig control software. My antenna is an off-center-fed dipole suspended on top of a telescoping fiberglass mast around 35 feet up in the air that was recently installed. It has a 4-to-1 ballon at the feed point and 50 feet of low-loss coax to my rig. Now, prior to this antenna installation, I had the exact same setup, except it was a metal mast, a mistake he admits here, that I took down due to safety issues. But oddly, I had no RFI issues with that setup. It seems that by going to a fiberglass mast that perhaps something had been altered. As far as my station setup, it is far from ideal since it's on the second floor of my house, and thus trying to run a ground wire to earth may be foolhardy since it would cover a pretty long distance and perhaps act as an additional antenna. So effectively, nothing is grounded in my station. As a first pass, would you recommend some FT24061 Abaddon chokes, referencing your May 2009 QST article on RFI, for all the cables? For your information, the USB cable connecting my rig to the computer already has an RFI suppression choke on it, but that may not be the entry point to the computer. Moreover, the issue seems to only happen on 20 meters. I'd appreciate any advice or input you may have. Whew.
Okay, well, gave me a chance to collect my breath there. Well, that does sound like a classic RFI problem, and it should yield to standard remedies. Because it didn't happen before, that means it probably is not the result of radiation direct from the antenna. Presumably that would be the same with either of your masts, and I'm sort of assuming from your observation that there's the difference in the mast that made the difference. So if it's not radiation from the antenna itself that's getting into things, it's probably common mode current on the coax that's entering the shack. Your 4-to-1 current balance should help that, but it may also have radiation coupling from the antenna to the coax. And what could have happened would be that the metal mast was taking some of that current directly to ground, being coupled directly to the coax that was coming down it. And by removing that, you've eliminated that path to get rid of the common mode current. That's just speculation. But in any case, what you need to do is eliminate that in some other way. And a common mode choke at the bottom of the coax, the bottom of the mast in the coax, would eliminate any coupling of from your antenna to the coax that's adjacent to the fiberglass mast. If you happen to have any slack in the coax and just could wrap it perhaps half a dozen turns around a 6-inch diameter piece of PVC, you would be able to use up your slack and probably eliminate any current that was coupled to that section of the coax. I like that arrangement better than adding a separate coax choke, because that requires an additional pair of connectors, and having UHF connectors outside is always asking for trouble unless you have spent a lot of time getting them waterproofed. So using the existing coax is the best. Now, to go to your other topic, RF grounding, it can be tricky to do a proper grounding on the second floor, but in my opinion, you should make a local ground island of all your equipment, establishing a single point ground at your station and tying all equipment, including power supplies and your PC chassis, to it with direct short connections. The single point can then be extended to your RF ground outside, or if you can't do that, at a minimum, tie it to the green wire of your AC system, because that gets to a ground rod back at the power distribution panel when the power comes into your house. Now, I've found in many cases you can pick up a connection to the green wire by tying to the chassis of your power supply. But check that with an ohmmeter. Make sure that the chassis is connected to the green wire on the plug. And if so, you can make that your single point ground. That's the way I've done it at my station. Now, that might not have a big impact on your RFI problem, although it could help. The main thing it will do, it will make your station safer, so you won't have a potential between pieces of equipment, which can happen either due to lightning-induced currents or even equipment malfunction. And it will also help avoid any problems with lightning that does come into your system. It'll have it all go back towards the power ground system and avoid connections or completing current paths through the equipment, which can happen if you don't have grounds from each of the ground terminals on the equipment going directly back to the common point. If that common mode choke doesn't help back at your antenna, you may need to dig a bit deeper. The first thing I always recommend is isolating everything. Remove every connection to your radio gear and your PC, except the minimum you need for them to run, because you don't really know how it's getting in there. And then find out if you still have the problem. And if you do, then add one cable at a time and see if the problem comes back. Now don't keep adding them consecutively. Do each one separately, because it's possible you'll have more than one source. That way you can find it. Once you know that, you're in a position to attack the particular cable or cables that are causing RF to get into your computer or your radio. And even though a cable has a lump on it that some computer manufacturer put there, that may work for certain frequencies, perhaps TV band frequencies, but it may not be effective at HF, because they don't really design their equipment to be usable in HF-rich environments. Find the cables that it's coming in on. You put a choking arrangement on each one as close to the place that's having the problem, the PC or the radio end. Do that on every cable, and you'll probably solve the problem.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Joel.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for the doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.